Hello everybody and welcome to Mind Clickers. My name is Lachlan and I am a sport and exercise scientist from Melbourne, Australia with a passion for esports performance, coaching and overall mental well-being. I've been into esports for quite some time, previously competing in COD 4 Pro Mod and avidly rushing to 10th Prestige in MW2. I previously also coached StarCraft 2 and love queuing into ranked games on CSGO. I created MindClickers to provide an insight into the psychological and performance demands of elite level gaming. This includes getting an insight from athletes, coaches, management, and allied health professionals about their roles within the esports scene. In the following episode, I talk with Violetta Ivanova, a physiotherapist from Finland who is engaged within the esports physical health scene and also loves competing in hackathons. Violetta previously completed her thesis looking at carpal tunnel within esports, which we'll go into further in the episode. Violetta's insights should be acknowledged from all current and past gamers who have a passion for casual or competitive gameplay. Ensuring your physical health, whether that be ergonomics or exercise, is crucial, alongside ensuring set practice or playing time. My voice is a little bit croaky in the intro, but don't worry about it, the episode is crispy clean. Thank you very much, and I hope you enjoy. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Season 2, Episode 3 of Mind Clickers, where it's time to click both heads in 2020. I'm joined here today with by Violetta Ivanova, who is a physiotherapist from Finland, who recently did some research in the esports scene looking at carpal tunnel and kind of the injury scene in esports. How are you going today?
Hi, thank you for having me. Pretty good.
Yeah, good to hear. I'm glad that you know, we finally got the opportunity to jump on the podcast. Obviously, we've been in discussion for a little while. But yeah, happy to have you on.
Yeah, likewise. And I'm also glad that we figured out the time zones at last.
Yeah, figuring out the time zones between Finland and Australia is a little bit of a mischief, but we managed to get it done.
Yeah.
So I guess we'll just start off with a background about yourself, you know, what you studied and where your passions lie, especially in the esports scene.
I graduated as a physiotherapist from Seto Kunto University of Applied Sciences. And as you mentioned, my paper was on carpal tunnel syndrome symptoms in esports players. In my work, I have had mostly neurological patients in rehabilitation. Most recently, I was in pediatrics with school-age children, mostly ADHD, ADD, and autism, also in rehabilitation.
Fantastic. And what is it that made you go down that line of work into, you know, pursuing the course of a physiotherapist?
I think physiotherapy is one of those jack of all trades kind of profession, or at least has the potential to be. It is very physical, but it also has a lot of opportunities around it. So that was kind of my motivation, as well as having experienced personally a lot of very bad advice coming from healthcare. I've always had a love for technology as well. So I felt like there has to be a way to improve methods that clearly aren't working anymore. So that was behind my decision to just go for it and see how I can contribute with the future treatment, especially in rehabilitation and injury prevention.
Yeah, for sure. I love that. Definitely over here in Australia, physiotherapy is one of those biggest domains that everyone's trying to get into. And if you don't get into physio, it's kind of like a waterfall effect. So essentially, the people who try and get into physio, if they don't get that, they go into exercise physiology. If they don't get into that, they might go into OT or, you know, it's kind of like a waterfall effect. So it's a pretty competitive area over here. How is it over there in Finland? Is it the same kind of thing?
We actually have a good amount of Australian students in physiotherapy over here.
because so that's where they've gone.
Yeah, it is a lot easier, I would say, for them maybe to get in here because it is a very large country with very small population. And physiotherapy has a very long-standing tradition in the Nordic countries. And it goes around the health promotion and that kind of holistic approach rather than from a medical perspective. So it is a very lucrative place to study. It's very high quality education as well, as most of the Nordic countries have. And I could totally see why Australians would like to try their luck in here, despite the complete difference between being always warm in Australia and now we're having barely 6 hours of somewhat daylight outside. As far as the program in here is, we are one of the few that have English-based physiotherapy. And I think for us here, it's a lot more difficult to get in because they take very few people. But otherwise, the education is so that pretty much everyone interested in healthcare and well-being can find something for themselves in it.
Yeah, for sure. And I love that term you used, you know, as physiotherapy is like the jack of all trades. So you have a role in obviously helping on the physical side of things. You have a role in helping in the rehab kind of things, and you're really engaging all those different kind of topics and ultimately with the ultimate goal to improve people's quality of life and, you know, with the aim to return them back to work or sport or even just improving, you know, being able to have a healthy lifestyle.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is still in the more traditional sense of physiotherapy where you work with clients. But you can also work in construction companies when discussing accessibility. You can work for a furniture company that assesses ergonomics or do assessments at workplaces on ergonomics if a new factory is being created. You can be involved in sleep. You can be involved in education and just a lot of different options in technology. Prosthetics, different walking robots, exoskeletons, and so on. Or on the more fun side, you can also be involved in making video games that revolve around rehabilitation. And that is one of the up-and-coming areas which I would personally like to get more involved. And I think it's it is the approach of the future of how we prescribe exercise to clients that they actually do.
Yeah, for sure. To be honest, if you put all those topics into a giant pot and pick one out, it sounds like all of them will be interesting enough to engage in, to be honest. It really does sound like everything's really in the mix there. So recently you published a research paper and, you know, you started to look into carpal tunnel syndrome symptoms in esports players. So how did the idea of everything around that come around?
The idea started initially with us having a heart rate monitor as part of our just general measurements and training courses in university. So the first beat monitor that I had on, we had to wear for about a week and record what we do during that time. So I was playing some games on my own, and once I saw the report, it showed that basically the report said that this is the type of cardio activity that you should be doing, and it was equal to a very light jog that I did the next day. So it got me wondering, okay, what other physical aspects are there when it comes to gaming that we don't really know of? Because there is not really much research. Now there's thankfully a lot more coming in, but at the time, we're talking 3 years ago or so, there wasn't really much. So I started looking into what would be possible to write a thesis on, what would be feasible, as it is just a bachelor's thesis and I'm the only person doing it. So it had to be as narrow as possible topic. And as my interest in neurology grew, I thought, okay, let's try with the carpal tunnel syndrome. And the main idea behind my thesis is to see whether playing for longer, or ideally playing more video games, does that equal to more symptoms, or is the problem really somewhere else? Because everybody really likes to say, oh yeah, if you play a lot of video games, that's going to ruin your wrist or something like that. But it's not based on anything. It's just guessing. Everyone who says that, or in comparison to gaming office work, because you use the same computer and mouse, right? They claim that, yeah, it's a high-risk profession for, in this case, carpal tunnel syndrome. But once you go through the research, it's actually a very low risk profession. So I wanted to know what is the case. I signed with a team. It's TIC Esports in Finland. It's a very small team, but it's local to me. So they agreed to record a symptom diary for a week. Okay. Which check through symptoms in both mouse and keyboard hands. I wanted to know if they have the typical carpal tunnel syndrome symptoms, which would be burning, numbness, pain. Do they transfer to the elbow? Do they transfer to the shoulder or somewhere else? And then based on that, they were also recording a mouse movement measurement with Mousetron software. So I wanted to know exactly how much they moved their mouse, because such measurements didn't exist yet. So after everything was recorded for a week, I went over the results and basically did a correlation between the symptoms and how much travel distance they had with the mouse. What we found was that there wasn't exactly a correlation for carpal tunnel syndrome. However, burning symptoms, which appeared in only the mouse hand, they were showing that the longer travel distance you do with your mouse, the higher risk for getting those burning symptoms was, and then that was also correlated with a performance drop. So for carpal tunnel syndrome, you would need both hands to have the symptoms. In this case, it was just the mouse hand, so just a simple overuse of the wrist. And of course, my study is not industry relevant in any way. It was just 8 people sample. However, it opens the question, what we don't know yet about gaming, what other physical stresses are involved in gaming, and who is at potentially high risk. Because if moving your mouse hand a lot means that your symptoms may increase, then is that a higher risk for FPS players that have lower mouse sensitivity? Or is there something else involving in it? So that was just to open the conversation about health of esports players, of potential injury prevention programs that can be put in place, because so far there isn't any of it.
Yeah, for sure. Some really fantastic things to really pull apart from that. Yeah, so essentially awesome thesis, you know, at the get-go. I really admire you. You know, you stepped up and you found like a kind of like a niche, essentially, within the esports area. And I think when it comes to performance tracking in traditional sports, you know, a lot of people engage in performance tracking, whether it be in, you know, basketball or rugby or soccer. There's a lot of performance around that. However, when you compare esports to traditional sports, there's not a lot going on. And, you know, looking at ergonomics, for example, in your situation, I think it's awesome because, you know, we can even take into consideration back, for example. I know a lot of esports athletes tend to hunch over a little bit. Is there some correlation between, you know, back injuries and, you know, performance and potential for, you know, having at LANs all ergonomic seats, for example? And, you know, as you said, even just wrist injuries and, you know, finger injuries, I actually can kind of resonate with that because I interned at a physiotherapy clinic for, I think, about 4.5 months. And a lot of the cases were just usual work officer individuals coming in, you know, complaining of wrist actions. And it was because of, you know, their ergonomics wasn't set up properly. You know, they were having, you know, kind of wrist symptoms and they were experiencing fatigue and soreness and numbness over time throughout the day. And I think that, you know, when you look to esports, a lot isn't actually being focused on for the players' physical health. I think in recent times, we're starting to look a bit more towards mental health. We're starting to bring in the psychologists. We're starting to bring in the counselors to really get an understanding of how the players are feeling mentally. But definitely physically, there needs to be that consideration put in place to ensure that the athletes have longevity. Because ultimately, you know, a lot of esports careers don't last long. And with having these higher risks, it just shortens the lifespan as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think ergonomics is a good point. I think it is very important to have a very well set up, essentially workstation. If you will be spending the next 8 hours at your computer, then it is your workstation and it should be set up correctly and having comfortable furniture that is designed for you and for the way that you will be using it. I think it's a good first step. However, it is not enough. Only having good ergonomics will get you as far. The problem will still come from just too much doing, too much playing, too much not taking breaks, and the way that overuse injuries happen is when you basically don't take breaks, you overdo what you're doing, and it leads to continuous agitation in the tissue. And there's no, unfortunately, ergonomics that will save you from that. It is very important for players, for coaches to learn that there are risks and you can prevent them by taking breaks, by having appropriate structure for the daily grind, essentially. How at workplace you would know when you have your breaks, when you can have a stretch, when you can have a little bit of food on the side or a drink and then go back to what you're doing. Because continuously grinding for 8 hours a day is not sustainable. It doesn't lead to better performance. In fact, your performance will decline over time because you will get tired regardless. And the more tired you are, the more of the negative results you will get.
Yeah, for sure. Great points there, especially, you know, I think a lot of people go into it, especially those really starting to get into esports. And they think that in order to really get better and to really get noticed by a team, you know, maybe if they're streaming on Twitch, that they really need to have an emphasis on the grind. And they really think that longer gaming sessions will ultimately lead to ultimately better performance. And I think it's that mentality they get trapped in, because I think if you have structured maybe like 3 hour set sessions, you can really start to hone in and understand, okay, these are the 3 hours I'm really going to try and perform my best. And, you know, obviously after those 3 hours or, you know, 4 or 5 or whenever we set the boundaries, that's where we can start to evaluate, well, how did that go? Was those 3 hours enough? How well did we perform those 3 hours? And I guess that's a good a question for future research. Who's going to set these boundaries and how are we going to establish these effective boundaries for performance? Is it going to be the coaches that are going to be, you know, saying, okay, we're only going to be training for this long? Is it going to be external support staff like yourself, physiotherapists, sports psychologists, who are going to set these boundaries and say, well, you know, research has shown, you know, effective performance is only between 2 to 3 hours, full focused, you know, maybe that's 1 or 2 scrims. And another thing, there's 2 sides to that. You know, are the players going to accept that? Are they going to say, well, yeah, I understand that, and, you know, comply with that essentially?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the more research we get on it, the more understanding we will have of what are the actual effects, how long do your attention span, your performance, and everything else that goes with it, how long sessions are the optimal for performance, how long is the safest span of time that we can actually really push for getting some results, and of course what time frame is the safest for the players, at what point do symptoms appear, and at what point we have to really set the break times and address whatnot comes with it, whether it's mental fatigue, physical pain, or some other issues that need to be addressed. I think, as you said, 3 hours window is a really good time. Whether or not that's enough, we'll know hopefully soon if somebody does research on it. But there really needs to be a structure in the day, because 8 hours or some even would go for 10 hours every day, it's not sustainable. It gets you places, all right, but it's not sustainable after that. So we're seeing a very high roster turnover. We're seeing a lot of burnouts within about a year at high level, which is unacceptable in any way. Especially since a lot of the players are very young. We're talking 15, 16-year-old players who compete at a pro level. And after about a year, they're out because they got a burnout. So from a clinical point of view, as someone who has worked in pediatrics, that is scary and really needs to be addressed, because this is still a very young person we're talking about. And we need coaches that are familiar and educated in appropriate child development care if they want to take even younger players to develop them. I think a good comparison with traditional sports structure here would be football or European football. It is one of the best structured, organized physical activities that are team-based. We have a very good junior setup where kids will get very good quality physical training on football, but they would also get very high quality education at the same time, not at the expense of one another. Then we go to the semi-pros or the young adult leagues, where again we have professionals that know how child development is going to happen. They know how growth spurts are going to happen, and they can address problems that come with it appropriately. And once the players are 18, then they go to the pro leagues and they perform to their highest possible level. It is very well considered, very well structured system. So I think the esports industry in general has a lot to learn when it comes to what kind of people are involved in educating the players, in coaching them, in pushing them to high performance, and of course, how to best take care of the players to make sure that we have longevity in their careers, that they can perform on the top level for as long as possible and in the safest way possible.
Yeah, I really agree with some of those topics, especially, you know, having that regulated scene. I think one of the big disparities, especially here in OCE and maybe somewhere, you know, in NA and even in EU, the whole idea of having a regulated scene versus unregulated. And, you know, in an unregulated scene, you know, there's obviously people grinding and grinding that, you know, aren't actually getting that external assistance, and they aren't really, you know, being treated for positive quality of life in comparison to having a regulated program where everything's a lot more structured, like you said, you know, having people that are actually there caring for you, having set routines, having everything that's really in line for performance with that goal of longevity, like you said as well. I think that's one of the things that really creates a stable program and an effective program. And I think they're the key characteristics that will allow programs like that to flourish and also allow programs like that to continue to develop. Because, you know, over here in Australia, we have some programs, you know, universities are starting to adopt esports programs. You know, even some esports stadiums are being built. And I think, you know, the idea of these stadiums and programs being constructed is that the idea it will be a really big, strong, regulated scene. Because when you look at traditional sports, you know, you have governing bodies. And one of the biggest questions is, you know, how's esports going to be governed? You know, obviously there's those big top teams, the teams that really strive in performance. You know, you got your, you know, obviously EU and NA teams who are really at the top of all games. I think it'd be really interesting to have a look into the, you know, look into their background and see, well, how are they performing? How does everything work in the back end of stuff? And compare that to, you know, maybe a lower less organization. But I think the importance of having some sort of structured program is critical.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, we have the really big teams going on. Some countries have started to make their own esports associations, like Korea would have the KESPA, and mm-hmm. in Finland we have, it's locally called Seoul, but it doesn't have anything to do with the Korean Seoul. and in also in both of these countries, the esports association is part of the Olympic Committee. So comparing again to traditional sports, there are the big teams, but there is also a very large umbrella organization above them, which dictates what it means to be a pro. If you want to play on the pro league, then you need to have these structures set in place. And they are the ones who will be truly regulating what goes on in the sport, because there will be the independent body on top of everyone. And I think esports really would need that. There are the large teams, but there is still missing an organization that is above everybody that will release all the regulations, the injury prevention programs, and that will provide appropriate academic education to professionals that has some kind of a standard. Because like you said, a lot of universities are opening teams. They're opening programs for esports, but none of it is standardized. And I think in order to be able to provide equal care and equal coaching to everybody, no matter what country they're in, we would definitely need this kind of a large organization at the top.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, as you said, you know, with university programs opening in, you know, especially, you know, days where open days, who are those guys are targeting? They're targeting those straight out of high school, you know, who have maybe played and, you know, at that young age, you know, 15, 16, 17, who outside of high school, pretty much, you know, unless they're working, most of their time goes into gaming. So, you know, having that, you know, university level where potentially something's regulated is super appetizing. And I think that's where, you know, universities can start to really thrive on building a really structured and regulated esports scene. And it'll be really interesting to see what kind of takes different universities have and the different kind of regulations and the structure that each have, and where that difference between countries. And as you said, having an overbodying, have an overshadowing governing body to ensure that everything's regulated as well. You know, you look to traditional sports and, you know, we have WADA for performance, you know, supplements and drug-related stuff. Is there going to be something that, you know, really helps to look at esports performance health and really ensuring that each athlete and team is following the standards that should be met?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there was already some questionable substance abuse cases from Korea. Talk at least about anti-doping and that kind of regulation. That just shows how young the esports industry is. Like, something that we would have as a no-brainer in every other discipline, it's mm-hmm. not a thing in esports. And I think it's really needed, especially when we're talking about younger players, because that is really where it matters the most. And as you said, the the educational institutions can have a really good impact on showing how things should be organized. I loved your previous episode about the school system in Australia and how developing those esports teams within the school system. I absolutely love that the saying that kids will go home and play anyway. So mm-hmm. we might as well just keep them in the school, in a social environment, in a team environment. Put a teacher, there's always a teacher that likes to play video games somewhere. Put a teacher there, they are pedagogues, they're educated in pediatrics, they're educated in teaching. So put them there for the coaching aspect, make it social. I love the idea of having a mini tournament at the end of the year to show all the parents, because I think there is also a lot of a disconnect between parents and kids. In my work, I have quite often been the mediator between a parent that is very distraught that all their kid does is spend time playing video games or being on their phone. And at the same time, when you ask, okay, what games does he play? The parent has no idea. And the logic behind it is that, well, I don't play video games, so I don't really know what he's doing. But then when you put it into a perspective of, okay, does he have any other hobbies? Maybe hockey, maybe he likes to play football. And the parent says, yeah, twice a week, three times a week, we take him to practices and so on. And when you put it so that, okay, so your kid goes to hockey twice a week, you yourself don't play hockey, but you still take him and you follow through what he's doing. So how about we take that into games? So the kid likes to play video games. Why not you just follow how he's working on it and support in that? And if the kid wants to get better, you can get him coaching for it. It is already available. A lot of gamers, pro gamers, pro teams would offer coaching. So we're talking about the exact same thing. You don't have to play yourself to be able to support your child in whatever endeavors they want to do, whether it's music lessons, playing a sport, or simply gaming. There is a path towards mastery in all of these, and it might just be for fun, but something else could come out of it as well. So it is worth a try. And once you put it that way, the parents really understand. It's like, okay, so it's actually not all bad. Of course, we don't want kids playing 5-6 hours a day on top of already schoolwork and other hobbies, because we also want them to get good sleep. But it is definitely helping the conversation between parents and players, because through understanding and like having a really good conversation between them, we can ensure that there is once again appropriate development going on, and also a little bit of the stigma will come off from esports and gaming in general. If a lot more parents understand, if they're on board with it, and at the same time we have more research coming out, I don't want to say that it brings legitimacy to esports, because it is already pretty legit industry, but it does bring some substance to back it up.
Yeah, for sure. All really good points that, you know, ultimately when you step back and look at them from an external perspective, they all make reasonable sense, right? You know, as you said, you know, for myself personally, you know, I used to go to Taekwondo training, and my mum and dad used to take me there. And, you know, it's the same thing with a lot of kids, you know, where they're going to different sports trainings. You know, are their parents actually getting involved and, you know, sitting down and just saying, you know, hey, you obviously spend a lot of time gaming. It's obviously a passion of yours. It's a hobby that you like to, you know, participate in with your friends. You know, maybe show me a little bit more about it. And I think, you know, progressively we've seen that developing in recent years. A lot more parents start to get on board and even game with their sons or daughters. So I think it's something that's definitely starting to evolve. And you know, when I think to, you know, different events, for example, I had the opportunity to go to the Melbourne Esports Open, the MEO here in Melbourne. And one of the biggest events, you know, obviously, as you might know, it was a fortnight event. And, you know, a lot of parents came along just because the children were interested and the kids were, you know, keen to get on stage and, you know, see what it's like to be a pro gamer. And I think, you know, being a parent and going to that and, you know, understanding, you know, seeing their kids on stage, you know, it's really a different scene. And, you know, from a media perspective, as you said, there's a lot of stigma. And I think that once we start to flesh it out and, you know, really understand, you know, what esports is and where it can take to the external media sense, there's definitely a lot of growth for it. But yeah, I definitely think that, especially, you know, comparing traditional sports here in Australia as well, we have uni games. So in that sense, you know, we have traditional teams, you know, baseball, hockey, football, soccer, whatever. They all travel to, you know, a different state and they participate, you know, versus different universities. And whether, you know, esports can get involved in that and, you know, make it, like you said, an end of year competition where there's different universities battling it out. It's really something that's going to be interesting to see in the near future.
Yeah, absolutely. And it, the current esports scene is very, I would say like 90% of it is really high end, top, massive organizations that are involved. And we are missing that amateur level. We're missing the semi-pro level. There are, of course, teams at competing at that point, but it's not that well developed. And I think through schools and through college level, university level, we can really fill in those parts and make sure that people have the step up opportunity. And if they really have a talent, then they can get appropriate education in the area and then follow through with the pro teams after they're done their ladder climbing, essentially.
Yeah, for sure. And I think when we look to external media, for example, I think one of the biggest things that's hard for esports is that sometimes the dark overshadows the light. For example, you know, if, you know, someone has to retire from esports at an early age due to injury, due to risk, when you look to recent years, there's definitely someone that comes to mind, and that's Uzi. And he, someone part of the Chinese League of Legends team, and he had to actually retire at the age of 23 just because, you know, he started to feel weak. He couldn't raise his arms. He couldn't sit down for long periods of time. He had degeneration and he also developed type 2 diabetes. But in the retrospect, you see positive cases where kids are getting in, they're communicating, they're talking with friends, they're engaging, they're doing critical thinking, they're engaging in pressure management. And a lot of these things that, you know, the kids really have adapted to in, you know, it's skills that you learn that maybe you don't learn playing a traditional sport. And I think that it's a matter of getting the media on side that there is positives. There's a lot of positives that can come out of esports, and it's not always the negatives.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think esports needs to find that balance. People are different, and so are health professionals and coaching professionals. I think there is definitely room for collaboration. We don't want to step on anyone's toes, obviously. So having that multi-professional team within an esports team can really make the difference, because every now and then there will be someone who is more prone to developing conditions, who is at some point maybe they have made the wrong choices because there was nobody to tell them what could be better, and it just continued. So this is where healthcare professionals would step in. In my personal view, my work will not be to sit behind someone's back and say, "Okay, now you take top, then you take bottom, then you can take over the other guy," and so on. That would not be my work. My work would be with a coach, making sure that if there is someone presenting symptoms for something that could be a yellow flag, a red flag, whatever, that there is the conversation between healthcare and the performance coaching going on. Because the same way that I'm not educated in performance coaching necessarily in esports team, performance coaches are not educated in healthcare and rehabilitation. So having that conversation together, educating the players on what are the risk factors, what are the symptoms that they need to be more mindful about. We don't fearmonger anyone, obviously. We just want people to really learn to listen to themselves, to report if something feels off somewhere. It could be nothing. It could be fixed with just a longer rest. But it is very important for players to understand that you should be able to speak up about any potential symptoms you may have. And there should be a coach that can pick that up and then make the call to get in, whether it's consulting, whether it's full-time, an appropriate healthcare practitioner that can alleviate the problem and really give the proper prescription, whether it's exercise or something else. And then together we can get the players back on track. It's all good. Then they can go back to the performance plan that they were following previously. But that is all to ensure that there are preventative measures being taken, which in the primary prevention, that would be ideally that the player never develops any kind of condition or that needs some kind of invasive treatment. Because in some cases, it's really difficult to catch things very early. We want to make sure that players can go back to that high performance, whether they've had surgery or needed some more time off. We need to ensure that they have a continuous career afterwards and don't need to retire at so quickly. A good example is, again, in traditional sports where you have longer contracts. You have about 5-year contracts and there is no pressure that you perform poorly one game or you get a flu or something that prevents you from playing for a game or two. That's fine. You can get better and you can get back into the game and you can keep winning for that overall winning streak. We don't necessarily have that in esports. The contracts are very short, which promotes that kind of grinding behavior and overusing behavior and ignoring symptoms, which it was also something that the players that I worked with reported that depending on what level they're playing, if it's just a practice session or if it's a competition, they might ignore symptoms or they might have really high-level symptoms, but in the moment, their performance is also really high because they can kind of switch it off. And it may lead to inappropriate or false reporting, which we also have in traditional sports. And it's not great because we don't want to stop anyone from progressing. We just want them to be as healthy as possible while reaching that top. That needs rephrasing. I don't want to step on anyone's toes and piss off some coaches here.
You're right. And I completely understand everything that you're coming from because it's logically, it makes sense, right? And I loved what you said about having like a traffic light system, having like, you know, maybe an amber or a red just so we can micromanage individual cases. And, you know, if something comes up, hey, we can start to flag that. We can start to, you know, is this something we should really take a step forward? Is this something that may become an issue later down the track? And, you know, I love what you said as well with traditional sports. Obviously, they have longer contracts. There's a lot less pressure to perform well. And I think, you know, when you look to esports, it's kind of like restocking the shelves with a new product. You know, every, you know, couple of months you see that an esports team has, you know, rostered on 2 new people. They've let go a couple of more. Maybe like a couple of months later, some more people have gone. Those original people have backed out. There's this constant managing going on in esports because contracts are short. And because of that duration, it really places a stress emphasis on the athletes to perform and, you know, really show that, hey, I am worthy of this role. I am worthy of, you know, being a part of the team. And I want to, you know, try my best. And, you know, that goes back and links back into that grinding and, you know, going into potentially poor habits. And it's kind of just like a big 360 circle of, you know, where we need to take a step back and really understand everything from an external perspective about, I guess, how we can develop a, you know, a system that really works in regards to performance. And obviously, you know, in recent times with G-Science, obviously they're starting to develop some really good, some platforms over there with Optimal, you know, and being able to, you know, develop a system that really allows coaches or performance coaches to, you know, get in and work with the athletes on a one-on-one, really understand how they're feeling. And again, being able to pick apart and micromanage different symptoms that they might be feeling to ensure performance, especially leading up to big tournaments as well, because that's where obviously athletes start to have that stress, they start to have that anxiety, and they start to fatigue as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, as you mentioned, metrics and measurement systems are really important to be developed specifically for esports, because only through that we can understand really what the stress is. And once we know the stress, we can affect on how do we get people better, what to watch out for, and what would be the best approach for it. But at the moment, there's a lot of talk of the consequences, but we don't know where does it come from. So it's kind of at the same time research advancing, and then there's the metric systems getting put in place with G-Science. And hopefully in the near future, we can kind of get to the same road, which is very exciting because... Mm-hmm. Then we can start to discuss a lot more with the players and coaches about implementing those systems.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that it's really interesting to think that, you know, in future times, what sort of research and metrics are we going to start to measure? You know, I know in recent times, and obviously what you referred to earlier in the episode when you talked about, you know, your heart rate and when you, you know, played some games, you know, was that spiking during intense situations? You know, did it rise during, you know, if you're going for a clutch, for example, and we can start, you know, have some measurements towards heart rate. We could also do breathing, you know. I definitely read that there was a couple of researchers that actually looked at breathing, especially in a land situation where maybe it was a, you know, a best of three or even a best of one. And in those really tense and stressful moments, a lot of players tended to hold their breath. And, you know, whether they performed well or not, you know, that was really impacting them. And, you know, it's really awesome to see that we can start to really dig deep and understand some metrics. Obviously, with eye tracking as well, starting to look and, you know, have a visualizational graph of where we are looking during different situations. And obviously, that's really awesome from a research perspective, because that just opens up a lot more wide opportunities to do with eye care and eye health. Obviously, we've got like blue light glasses that are starting to make its way into its esports scene. But I definitely think that, you know, the more metrics we can start to measure, just like traditional sports, it's just going to be better for overall health.
Yeah, absolutely. And from my part, I'm happy that there is a lot more focus on physical health, because so far it has been almost exclusively mental health and mental performance and stress management, mental coaching, sports psychology, and so on. But it is also something that affects physiology and physical well-being, and both of them need to be addressed together, because improving the physical part will give you better cognitive performance as well. And this we know already from research, so it can be readily applied to esports, as it is a very very cognitive work focused discipline. And I think a lot of coaches are starting to realize that. We have so far, there are very few teams that enforce this kind of team-wide physical and mental training programs. But I think a lot of teams are having single players here and there that might have their own trainer, that might have their own nutritionist. But I think in the near future, we really need to bring those multidisciplinary professionals together and ensure that the entire team is held up by those standards and that they're getting the professional growth that they have the potential to develop. And it's probably going to start from the top down. Like all the biggest organizations will get that first. And then everyone else will see, okay, clearly these are the benefits that we're seeing. So maybe we need to emulate some of that. And again, it doesn't have to be a full-time member of the team. You can get consulting. You can get someone in for a little bit just to do a session or two and then see how that works. So if there are any coaches or players listening to this, please do consider getting at least a session or two with a nutritionist, with a physiotherapist, someone that can really help ensure that your physical well-being is on par with your mental well-being, because both of them work together. You can't, unfortunately, you can't take your brain out of your head and only take care of that. You have to get the whole package.
Yeah, I love that. It's just like, you know, you can't have, it's just completing the whole piece of the pie, really. And I think that one of the biggest questions of mine is, how do we get these, you know, athletes and players and coaches to become open to, you know, thinking, okay, maybe we should start to think about physical, you know, we've been doing a lot of mental stuff. We've been tracking, you know, stress, anxiety, we've been tracking mental performance. We've been seeing how well they've been performing, cognitive fatigue during competitions in a best of three, a best of five, you know, ongoing those big, long, heavy grinding sessions. But we haven't been doing that. So how do we start to engage with these players and these guys to really, you know, broaden their perspective and, you know, take some accountability for their physical health?
I think a good portion of the justification would come from research, which there are a few papers in the works now. And I think that will also show current healthcare professionals who may have no idea of esports and gaming as a thing. Research will give them clues on what to pay attention on and how they can improve that. And the more of these professionals we get then involved in esports, they can better educate coaches. Because like at this moment, if a player goes due to some symptoms to their local healthcare center, I think no matter where they are in the world, the answer will be pretty similar. They will be told, well, just don't play that much video games then. But where this becomes a problem is, what if this is your job? We don't tell office workers, don't sit at a computer so much. No,
exactly.
Of course we don't. We take care of their symptoms, we rehabilitate them, and we get them back to working the same way that they were working before. So having that understanding as well towards esports players, and having the health promotion, I think language would be the better way to describe it, because you can't go with the typical health promotion that you would be going in a school, for example, with. It needs to have a very specific language if you want to promote it to esports players. And I think through showing the performance benefits would be a really good route, because, of course, players want results. They want to keep competing. They want to get the higher scores. So showing them what else they can do to help their performance, that would really, really might make them think twice about whether or not it's worth training, or if they would rather just keep grinding the way that they've been grinding so far.
Yeah, for sure. Just really starting to seek out that extra little edge that they need to maybe differentiate themselves between another member or another team. You know, obviously when it comes to trialing for a team, you know, you want to be able to have the extra edge over those extras trialing, and being able to physically show that, you know, I can, you know, have that really good structure. I understand the benefits. I understand the performance side of everything. I think it's crucial. I think it's pivotal to, you know, longevity, and all the points you've raised are just absolutely awesome. And other thing that I really wanted to bring up, as you talked about before, was just this whole idea of research, and maybe looking to a different idea or a different crowd for these research ideas. One thing I had a chat with you a little while ago was this whole idea of hackathons, and basically the idea that you hack an idea. So, you have companies who come in, and whether it's healthcare, business, commerce, and they bring a problem they have, and you participate in like a hackathon to essentially try and solve that problem. So can you explain to us a little bit more about how that works and, what you've done in the past?
Hackathons are a really fun system for getting your brain working in not necessarily an area you're familiar with, but also in a completely different field. It's based around really fast learning, mindstorming, and really getting a solution. And it's the basically the peak of problem-based learning, which a lot of universities will have in their curriculum as a way of teaching. I highly encourage anyone who has a hackathon near them, just go for it and see how it works. I think in Finland specifically, they're very common. Every area has at least one per year, or two in some cases. They are often oriented around business and technologies, but as the latest one we had, because in my city and my university are very AI focused and a lot of technologies are developed, we had also healthcare being involved. And it is very interesting to see what companies are doing, what they're looking for developing. And on their part, it's really useful to see what students think along the lines of what you're envisioning. So it's a great opportunity to network. It's a great opportunity to win if you happen to win. I think it's in terms of seeing what's developed around you, which you otherwise might not have access to knowing. And we haven't had yet esports themed, but I'm expecting to see in the following years, because a lot of universities are getting very involved. So maybe from the business perspective, maybe from the marketing perspective around esports, possibly finding new revenue streams or hacking how much they can change the current constructs to optimize it. The one I attended most recently and won was related to using VR games in rehabilitation and how to make that very accessible to as wider array of patients as possible, because patients might have difficulties holding controllers, pressing buttons, using fine motor skills. So our goal was to kind of hack that problem and make a solution that could work for literally anyone, no matter what their grip strength is, what their hand size is, and so on. I think technology really has allowed us to do that. And gaming is a fantastic way to include more people. It is very accessible. It is probably one of the most accessible disciplines out there. And with companies offering solutions for a more accessibility-mindful controller that has maybe bigger buttons, maybe some pedals. I think the Xbox had a really good, it was an entire suite of products that are aimed at people who wouldn't otherwise be able to use a normal controller. I think gaming is a great way to bring some social element to people, a lot of fun, because we are a bit stuck in the healthcare world that you can't have fun, that fun is bad because this is serious and this is rehabilitation and you have to follow the protocols and so on. But what we're seeing is that people just don't follow it because it's not fun. And once you make a rehabilitation process fun, because let's face it, nobody wants to follow a piece of paper with a couple exercises for the next 2 months, 3 months, half a year. Neurological patients might be in rehabilitation their whole life. So you want to have a really, really good communication with the people and to not be afraid of having fun with it. A lot of rehabilitation games are coming out that they use the exact same exercises that would otherwise be prescribed, that we know are effective, that we know work, that has been backed by science. Just they're making them fun, which makes people actually do them, because that's a problem where physiotherapy can't really help if the person doesn't actually do what you tell them to do. We can have all the knowledge, but if you don't do your exercises, then it's all for nothing. So using those motivational mechanics that gaming has, the fun elements and the social elements as well, can really bring people together. And it wouldn't necessarily matter where someone is. It wouldn't be mandatory for someone to go to a healthcare center to get a procedure to get better, especially now during COVID times. We can't always expect people to be going places for rehabilitation if they can also do something about it at home and not be put at risk, because a lot of rehabilitation clients are in risk groups. So it's giving them something nice to do at home that isn't boring and that is effective, and it's making them feel better and have some social support from other peers that are also playing the same game. And if we can help with technology to make sure that even more people have access to playing, whether it's VR, whether it's console or PC games, the more the better, basically.
Yeah, fantastic. I love that. I love the fact that there's, you know, as you mentioned, those motivational mechanics that allow us to, you know, have that accessibility to, you know, perform and to be engaged with, you know, those rehabilitation clients. I think, you know, in recent years, it's definitely been an increase in the amount of, you know, accessibility that's come out in terms of gaming. And as you said, you know, the Xbox controllers start to become more adaptable. There's probably going to be some PlayStation fans are a little bit salty about that. But it's definitely one of those things that I think is just absolutely incredible. And it just makes sense, you know. The fact that we have these rehabilitation clients that are coming in, they have the ability to engage with each other in VR. They have the ability to, as you said, do their exercises, because, you know, more often than not, we might prescribe someone something, but, you know, how often are they going to follow it? What percentage do we get a return that they're actually following what exercises or routines are set for them? And the easier we make that for them to follow, I think the higher return that we're going to have on its effectiveness. And I think that, you know, having something that's fun, having something that's sociable, having something that can engage with our interests a lot easier than something just as mundane as doing a couple of squats against a wall or doing some of those basic exercises, but incorporating into that VR realm and, you know, even adding a little bit of competition to it, it just makes everything so much more enjoyable.
Yeah,
so
lovely.
There you can go.
It's actually studied how much people will actually follow exercises, and the numbers were a bit shocking to probably a lot of healthcare professionals who are very eager to give a very thorough, very big program to somebody while not seeing the results that they would like to see. And that is just because people might follow two exercises. That's the maximum that they are on average following. Once you give them three, it starts to decline a bit. They might still follow it, but the compliance will start to decline. And the typical period at which they would follow the exercise would be about a week up to 2 weeks. And then it's just the paper gets thrown into a drawer and you forget about it because you might start feeling a bit better already. So you feel like, well, I don't really need to do that. It doesn't make me feel any different. And if you don't get another session with a physiotherapist after 2 weeks or a week, you might just forget about it. And it's like, well, I feel fine now, so I don't need to do that anymore. Well, if you get them to play a game, they will be much more willing to continue engaging in that. And I think VR is a great example. We have games like Beat Saber that there's been so many stories about people losing weight and being active during quarantine time, especially. Nintendo Ring Fit Adventure is also a great example. The UK sold out pretty much all samples when the spring quarantine hit in 2020. People really wanted it, and they realized that, okay, this is a good way for me to be active at home, because YouTube workouts are not for everyone, and having your own personal trainer is not possible for everyone. And, like, even for myself, I may be a physiotherapist, but I find it very boring to follow any kind of program at home. So I personally rely very heavily on PlayStation VR for my workouts, because it's just more fun. If somebody comes over, or if we want to have online competition, that's also possible, and it's just good fun. It just gives one more option for people, which when we're talking especially about gamers, they're already used to that stimulation from games. They love the mechanics that games offer them. So getting someone like that and putting them to follow a paper-based program, it's not gonna work. But if you put them to play a game instead that is a lot more familiar to them, it's gonna be with a lot better results.
Yeah, for sure. And I think one of the biggest similarities that I can relate to that is, you know, when it becomes the new year, a lot of people go out and say, oh, I'm going to join the gym, I'm going to get a gym membership. And 2 weeks later, exactly like you said, or 3 weeks, or even a couple of days, the gym card goes in the bag, the gym card goes in the drawer, and they don't really, you know, bat another eye towards it. And it's one of the biggest lucrative industries. It's definitely one of those interesting things. And as you said, being able to have, you know, accessibility, being able to have variety. I think variety and options are some of the biggest key things to ensure longevity, to ensure that people are engaging with it, because ultimately people hate to be narrowed down. People hate to only have one choice or two choices. And I think being able to explore more options, you know, within, you know, the next couple of years, I'm sure we'll see more innovative ideas come to the VR realm. That'll just give more and more options, and you can only see positive results from that.
Absolutely. I think that gym example is absolutely spot on. The unfortunate part about it is that, and we also saw the same after quarantine, where a lot of people were stuck at home. They started getting all kinds of restless feelings. So they thought afterwards, okay, everything is open now, let's go to the gym. What happens is that in similar case to that New Year resolution case, you get super motivated to gym. You might go 3-4 days in a row, completely overdue what's your capacity, get some kind of impingement, get some kind of pain, and maybe there wouldn't be appropriate trainer, because to go to the gym, you really need somebody to show you how you should do safely the exercises. There is a bit higher bar for like an entry level skill that you need to have. So if you are completely clueless with exercise, and maybe you have watched some videos on YouTube, it's not really enough. You need that person next to you to really see how you're doing things. Because even if you're yourself looking in the mirror and it looks all right, you always need someone to look from the side, because it might be a completely different case. And that higher barrier of entrance because, of course, personal training costs and there is a higher risk of injury. It might deter some people from going for physical exercise, but on the other side, if you have a system at home, whether it's Nintendo, PlayStation, Xbox, whatever, because it is a game, it's a lot easier to get into it and to get that initial fitness level. And it's usually very beginner friendly. There's usually a very low risk for injury. And after experiencing that, it's a lot better for people to really think, okay, I actually feel much better after this. Maybe I should seek something a bit more. So maybe then they look into physical training at a gym or a sports facility or somewhere where a professional will really train them and show them how more complex exercises could be done. But for home, for a very simple exercise routine, games are fantastic.
Yeah, I think all points, they really tick the boxes. And I think that one of the biggest examples is that, you know, people go to the gym and you kind of have two kind of different cases. You have those that are really starting out and those that feel a little bit self-conscious about themselves. And as you said, those are the newer beginners are more prone to injury because they don't know how to do the exercise correctly. They might have improper form. They might watch just be, you know, trying to do some exercise whilst watching YouTube on their phone and saying, oh, am I doing this? Am I looking in the mirror? And ultimately, that's not really something that is really positively reinforced because obviously, you know, it can lead to injuries. And then I think the flip side of that coin is you have those that come in and they think they know that they're actually doing what they are doing. They think that they know they're doing it right, but ultimately, you know, they're potentially causing more problems than they need to be doing. So I definitely think that, having that, you know, beginner-friendly entry level in regards to being able to do it at your home, it just allows, you know, everything to go a lot more smoothly in terms of starting new exercise programs and helping out in that situation.
Yeah, absolutely. And the goal is we want people to be active and we want people to be better, to feel good. And there are many options nowadays to achieve that. So, as you said, people like options, and I feel like a lot of people consider to be fit basically is bound to you're going to the gym or you're running, which isn't true. There's all kinds of different ways that you can keep fit, that you can keep healthy, and going to the gym is one option. If you enjoy it, go for it. If you like running, also go for it. If you just like walking, that's also an option if it's safe for you to do that. But also all kinds of active games and dancing and martial arts and not necessarily sports in the sense of like just typical football, basketball, volleyball kind of team sports. But also you can explore so many other different options that wouldn't necessarily be considered as typical physical activity options, but people would be surprised how many options around them they have. They might have a climbing facility that's just not as well advertised, or a boxing place that is also very small but provides very good advice in there. So our goal in physiotherapy as well is to make sure we know what the person likes doing and whether that is based in water, outdoors, indoors, or wherever. We take that into consideration and then apply what we know would work best for that person and implement it within that space that they really enjoy being in. Because again, if you like it, then that's a higher chance that you will stick to it.
Yeah, for sure. Definitely just allowing them to really engage with it and be understanding towards it can definitely help its case. So in regards to the future, you know, what are your perspectives? What are you looking to, you know, narrow in? Are you looking to get more into clinic-based physiotherapy? Are you starting to maybe, you know, think about esports on the side as well? Where does your mindset lie?
That is pretty much it. I would definitely like to keep having my clients in the rehabilitation field. I would also be very interested in working with teams, potentially working together with coaches and ensuring that the players get very good education on what their bodies do during gaming and how they can really spot those minute initial symptoms and report right away. I think transparency in this case will be key to making sure that people stay healthy. Working with coaches in terms of knowing when or rather where their line ends and to not overstep into an area that they may not be too familiar with, which I hope more coaches would be mindful of, because that is why we have such a wide variety of health and performance professionals, that we can all work together and ensure that players get the best they possibly can. So that would be something I'm really interested in, just really educating teams what health really means for them and how it can help their performance. As well as on the side, I would be involved in some research from healthcare point of view, because I think, like I mentioned before, education for healthcare professionals is really missing in terms of what esports is, what gaming is. A lot more people are doing it, so there is need to know how to properly address it. Rather than just dissing it as something that is just bad. That will come through research, having more case studies on esports players, seeing really what problems are common among esports players, whether it's wrists, low back pain, neck pain, muscle atrophy, how we can address it in the best way. Working to really set those foundations for possibly telehealth examination, because a lot of the players will be living in their own homes. So if you're in one location and then you have 10 players around the whole country, it's not realistic that you'll be traveling to each and every one of them. And unfortunately, a lot of the clinical tests are person-to-person based or face-to-face. So trying to adapt those into a virtual consultation or a virtual examination platform, that would be something I'm really interested in. Of course, doubling down on all the measurements and making sure that we really understand what gaming does to you and how we can help the best that we can to ensure that there is performance growth.
I think, I think definitely one thing we can take away from that statement is that you're definitely in the right field. The passion really shines through, you know, the enthusiasm, the vision, and even your understanding of just the complexity of how everyone's involved, you know, working in the multidisciplinary group. Everyone has their own role. We don't have a doctor who is also a strength and conditioning coach and also a physiotherapist. We don't have one key individual. We have a group, and there's a reason for that. And I definitely think I agree with you. You know, we need to really, you know, some people really need to understand that there is a boundary to your, you know, your vision and, you know, how well you work within a group. And I really think it's definitely something that's going to be awesome to look forward to in terms of the future and how everything starts to progress.
Absolutely.
So, yeah. So, you know, just starting to wrap up now, I think we definitely had a really awesome chat. Throughout everything, I think we really touched on some awesome pieces, your research and your theses and the understanding of the importance of different risk injuries in terms of esports and also just clinical work as well, and how that can translate into, you know, understanding the properties of ergonomics and really understanding those injuries, and then also the measurement systems in regards to, you know, how we can start to track in terms of the future. And, you know, really getting an understanding of about having those regulated systems in place to ensure longevity and stability and consistency and efficiency and effectiveness with esports as well. So I really appreciate you coming onto the podcast and having a really big in-depth chat. I definitely think it's one of the in-depth that I've done, but it was an absolute pleasure. For those listening, where can we find you on socials? Are you active on any of your socials?
Thank you on my part so much for having me. I know that this is not the most typical topic that people would like to talk about, as healthcare professionals are not at all common in esports. But I think it is important for players and teams to know what we can offer them, the expertise that we have, and how we can work in synchron with all the other existing professionals in esports so far. As far as social media goes, I think LinkedIn would be the most active for me. You can find me at Violeta Ivanova there. And also at Discord, which can be disclosed in the comments.
Perfect. I really appreciate you taking the time to come on. And I'm really glad that we managed to get there in the end, especially with the time differences between Finland and AUS. But yeah, I really appreciate it. And to everyone who managed to stick around, thank you very much. I hope you take away a couple of really good points from Violeta today. They can really be applied to yourself or, you know, to a friend or someone that you can really help to assist in a daily life.
Yes, thank you so much.
No worries. Have a good day.